take some looks at the seventh Aliyah of Shemini. So Shemini, as you know, is a lot about food, and this closing Aliyah is as well. We've already been introduced to, earlier in the parsha, to the whole notion of what behemoths are kosher and which ones aren't, and which fish are kosher, and which birds. So in this Aliyah, we're going to talk about shratzim, and we're going to talk also about tumas ochlim. So we'll start with that. I probably won't read every pasuk inside, so that we'll be able to cover a little bit more. But the first pasuk starts with this din of tuma by a klicheres. Pasuk says, "V'chol klicheres asher yipol mehem al tocho, kol asher basochi yitma v'yoso sishbaru." So let's say you have a utensil that's made out of clay. So if a sheretz is going to fall into it, so that tumah is going to fall into it, so then the tumah is going to be passed through the inside of the kli, and the only thing you can do is break it. Now, we know tumah v'tara is always a little hard to connect to relate to, but al pi derech ha'adrush, there is a nice discussion about this kli cheres din, I'm going to say for Yunava Parsha, Avram Heschel Reisman, who's the father of Ritzvika Reisman, who we were, I believe, talking about at some point last week, or before Pesach. So in this Sefer, talks about the themes behind this notion of a Kli Cheres. And I'm not going to say over everything he says, but one of the ideas that he points out, it's interesting that there are Chumras and Kulas compared to other types of kelim. So when it comes to a kli cheres, so it doesn't become tameh from touching it on the outside, but on the inside it does contract tuma, and simply putting something in its airspace is enough to be metameh it. And once that happens, you can't really fix it the same way. You can't be tovel it, you have to break it, as the pasuk here says. So in terms of the imagery, so he talks about the fact, this is also really just in terms of halacha, just in terms of understanding the concept, but it has to do a little bit with hashkafa of different kelim as well, that the kli cheres presumably doesn't have inherent chashivas. If you have a gold kli, so then that is important because it's gold. But here, the chashivas comes from its function. It functions as a container, so its containment space is its focus. So touching on the outside is not really significant. But entering into its space, even without touching its space, is significant. And then once that has happened, so then its whole nature has become contaminated, and it has to be destroyed. And he points to a number of makaros. Just one to mention is the Gemara Maseches Nedarim and Daf Nun Amud Beis, where he talks about the dialogue between the daughter of the Caesar and Yeshua ben Chanina. The daughter of the Caesar was apparently not so impressed by his appearance, and she said to him that as a Talmud Chacham, he is a ugly container for beautiful things. So he said to her, "So tell me, your father who has a wine collection, where does he store the wine?" So she says, "He stores it in earthenware containers." So Shua ben Chanina said to her, "Well, why doesn't he put it in gold and silver and in fancy containers that parallel its value?" So she said, "Oh, good idea." Okay, so they did that, and the wine spoiled. It's not a way to store wine. And the suggestion was that there is some parallel there, and apparently the notion that can be addressed is that the Talmud Chacham, who contains the Torah, so he is modest and he's mevatel himself to the Torah, so he does not consider the kli to be the focus, and that's why the Torah is able to be well preserved within him, while one who is Balgaivan, one who is very focused on himself, So the kli is not an effective container for Torah, and that's where this imagery conveys this message. Okay, so let's also look at the next pasuk. So the next pasuk here, talking about the food, the pasuk has the phrase Mikol ha'uchel asher ye'ochel asher yabol of mayim yitma v'chol mashke asher yishase v'chol kli yitma. So the food, all of this food, is able to impart tumah when it is itself tameh. So there are a couple of interesting halachas here. The Mishnah says in Taras that kol hamiyuchad ochel adam tameh ad sheyifsal meachilas kelev. Right, here is some terminology which we're familiar with from Pesach, and we'll see a couple things like that. Hopefully, time permitting, we'll see some good synergy today also. I mean, this week we've been talking about machalos asuris, and we'll see some overlapping ideas. But here the Mishnah says that the food that is designated for eating is tameh until it becomes nifsal me'achilas kalav. So there's a machlokis, the Rambam and the Ravid had to understand this din, this is the Hochos Tumas Ochel and Beis Yudalid, that probably the Pasher way to understand it is like the Ravid, that food is considered food until it's nifsal me'achilas kalav. So that defines for all purposes of Tumas Ochlin, to contract Tumas Ochlin, to convey Tuma to others. But the Rambam has a more specific understanding, and he says that food that became Tumay already, while it is Roy, if it becomes Nifsal from Me'achilas Kelev after that, so it still holds on to its Tuma, but it's not Mekabel Tuma anymore at that point. So Rav Asher Weiss, who has a discussion about this and a few other things in our Aliyah, so we'll mention him a good number of times in the next few minutes, he suggests there's two different dinim here. That one, there is a concept of the shame ochel, that the food has to be considered food. But also, functionally speaking, it has to be omed la'achila, that it has to be something that people can eat. And that we see from the language of the pasuk, mikol ha'ochel asher ye'ochel. It's two things. It has to be ochel, and it has to be ochel that can be eaten. So therefore, the status of tumah can stick within it, even if it's not in the position of omei la'achila, that it can confer tumah. And he discusses further the question of the shear, how much food do you have to be relevant to these halachos. So here there's a distinction as well, that as far as being makabel tumah itself, any amount is able to be makabel tumah. But as far as being matame others, it has to be a kibetza. And the Rav Asher suggests that that also is a part of the concept here, that it's not just the shem ochel, but it has to also be omed la'achila. So if it's not a significant amount that a person can be satiated with, so then that's not omed la'achila. And therefore, that's going to be disqualified on that front. Okay, so let's skip over a little bit to Shratzim, which is a major theme in the Parsha. We have to talk about that for sure. Major theme in this Aliyah. So that starts from Mem Aleph, Chol HaSheretz, HaSheretz, Chol HaAretz, Sheketz Hu Le'achel, Kol Helech Al Gachon, Kol Helech Al Arba, Ad Kol Mar Beregalim, Chol HaSheretz, HaSheretz, Al Aretz, Lo Sochlum, Ki Sheketz Hein. Al Teshaktsu Es Nafsha Sechem, Chol HaSheretz, HaSheretz, Velo Sitamu Bohem, Vinit Mesem Bam. So these three psukim together, which talk about this whole concept of sheretz. So we have a couple of repeated phrases here prohibiting shratzim, up to say six. So as the machlokas, Rashi and the Rambam, how to understand this multiplication of lavin. So the Rashi understands that it's possible to accumulate all within one iser. You could have one action, you could have a number of sets of malchus, because the Torah is repeating the idea, and then if you have an animal that does both swimming and flying and all kinds of other activities, so then you're going to rack up a higher list. And the Rambam disagrees. The Rambam says that you don't have multiple malchus for one action, and if we have additional isurim, so either it's there for emphasis, or it's talking about different animals, so it has to identify the different categories. But you're not multiplying all the malchus onto one action. But in any event, the Gemara in Vedazara, Daf Samaches and Midbeis, which was Daf Yomi not so long ago, in the past few weeks. So the Gemara there says, relating to the whole concept of the Shvatzim, says that it's a chidushu, that normally this is something that we would be disgusted by and naturally separated from. So because of its chiddush, so it's usur, despite the fact that it detracts from the taste of what it's combined with. It's called nosin tam lefgam. Normally that would be a reason to be lenient. Here we are prohibited nonetheless. So what does it mean to call it a chiddush? So it sounds like from Rashi over there that it's a chiddush because who needs the isur if people are disgusted by it anyway? So then we don't need the Torah to come and prohibit it. And that's in sync with the idea of Ratzah Kadosh Baruch Hu L'Zakos Es Yisrael, that even things which we would otherwise stay away from anyway, the Torah creates a prohibition so that we can rack up points on our behalf. But Tosus over there points out that's not what we mean by chiddush, though. The phrase chiddush normally means a davar hasoser asaklal. A chiddush means, in Talmudic language, that there is something that deviates from normal rules. So to say that it's a redundant prohibition, that's not really a chiddush. A chiddush would have to be something that doesn't seem to fit. Question about that?
It's schar for every moment that you're not committing an
isur. So you're saying only for positive mitzvahs should you get schar?
Or yeah.
So here's the Rabbeinu Yonah, that the Rabbeinu Yonah says that there's the Gemara that has a statement that Yashav Adam Vol Avar Avera, person sits and he doesn't violate an avera, so he gets a mitzvah. So Ben Yon explains that the mitzvah is a mitzvah of Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim counts. But presumably, especially when you have a kiyum, and we'll see here, there are some things that you have to do in order to avoid the whole situation, although you have to figure out how that's going to enter into this calculation. But Lamaisa, observing the din, is something that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is able to calculate. So here you would have stayed away anyway, but it's an extra schus for us that now we are considered to be Yirei Shamayim for staying away.
But are you not doing it just because you're disgusted by it nonetheless, and not necessarily because of the Yirei Shamayim, but still you get
it? Presumably. Again, HaKadosh Baruch Hu's accounting is a little bit beyond us, but that's normally how it gets into some interesting cheshbonos about when do you say that you should want to do the din? When do you want to say that it's even better if you want to go the opposite? There's a lot of philosophy behind that, but a short answer is yes. Okay, so Tosu says that it's not a chiddush to say it's redundant. A chiddush is something that goes against the existing rules. So what Tosu says, and it still fits with the language of the Gemara, both Rashi and Tosu, they both fit with what the Gemara says, is that the fact that people are disgusted by it, so then, as we've been talking about this week, so that should make it not an achila. That should make it not considered an action of eating, and therefore it should be mutter for that reason. So the fact that it's aser is the chiddush. But the chiddush component does have nafkaminas, because the Shulchan Aruch writes in Kuf Zayin that in order for it to be prohibited, it has to be it itself. That the tam, the way we normally confer taste, something is cooked in something, so it confers tam, and that creates a prohibition, even if the physical item is no longer there. That's where all of our kitchen shilas really come from, or many of them. So here, for the bugs, the tam is mutter. It's only the bug itself, which is actually usur, and that's a part of the unique component of it. So as you know, bugs are buggy issue. They bug us a lot in a lot of different ways, and they are big problems with small things. So there is a lot of discussion, as you can imagine, and the Binas Adam in Simon Lamed Aleph, so he quotes from the Sefer HaBris that he was informed by the scientists that the vinegar has tiny little bugs in them, and that if you take a microscope or you take a magnifying glass, you can see them, so therefore it should be prohibited. So many, many svarim, including the Binas Adam, who quotes this, and the Aruch HaShulchan and Moshe Feinstein and many others before and after, point out that they don't think this is a problem. because in order to qualify as a prohibited bug, it has to be visible to the naked eye. Otherwise, ein l'davar sof, because there are bugs all over the place, and they are microscopic, and we live with them in all different kinds of contexts. We swallow bugs every time we breathe. So Rav Asher Weiss points out that, okay, that's not necessarily a proof, because we don't have an issur of swallowing, of inhaling, but that's not considered derech achila, but maybe we have to be more machmir regarding what's in the food. But still, in a chanami, we never have anything to eat if we're going to aser bugs of any size. So the issa presumably applies to that which can be seen with the naked eye, which is a klal that comes up in Kol Torah Kula. It's a discussion in many areas of halacha. For example, we talk about the tefillin has to be square, but geometrically, to have a perfect square is going to be pretty impossible, because a square means four equal sides. And if you have hypersensitive measuring equipment, you'll always find a difference between one side and the other. So we don't mean that you have to go beyond normal human perception in order to assess it, but what we see as four equal sides is called a square. Israel, understand the first?
So, just if the answer is the bug that you can see with the naked eye, why are we so mocked that, like, by lettuce, for example, where we're constantly checking a gazillion times for bugs?
So that's an important distinction to make, because there you can see. And so you don't use a microscope to look for bugs. You don't use a magnifying glass to look for bugs. Now you'll say, well, what about a light box or something like that? So that's a different story. And this is something, again, we'll talk about more in a second. This is a point that the Rav Asher Weiss emphasizes a lot in the discussion we'll mention more about in a minute. But that it's one thing if you can't see it because it's against a background that makes it hard to see. So that's not called invisible to the naked eye. But if it's too small to be perceptible, okay, so then there's what to talk about, or nothing to talk about. But if you can't see it, you just have to look hard, but you don't have to use a magnifying glass, you don't have to use a microscope, so that's a different category. And again, if the issue is the background is obscuring, it's camouflaged, so then that's also not going to help us so much, so that's where light sources come in. Hi.
Isn't there also discussion if you can see something's there, but you can't tell it's a bug?
So there is such a discussion. So Rav Asher Weiss, again, he's writing all over the place. I'm particularly quoting from his essays, which are published in his Sefer on Vayikra. So in his Sefer on Chumash and Parsha Shmini, we're making reference to a number of those essays. So there he has published a tshuva about the great controversy that affects us here in the Big Apple. Not the apples, but the water. The question of the insects in the water. So as you know, this is a highly controversial issue. Do we require filtering on such things? Do we require filtering on the water that has these bugs in it, which is a specific New York problem? So I'm not here to take a side in that specifically, as you know, it's a big machlokas within our yeshiva and elsewhere, but just to relate Rav Asher Weiss's discussion about it. So he makes that point that if it was only visible with a microscope, then, okay, here you have the consensus of postman that that's not a consideration. But the problem is these bugs are very, very small, but apparently if you look hard, you can see them. Now, Daniel raises the issue, which he talks about also, that what if, maybe you should make a distinction, what if you can see them but not identify them as bugs? Should that be a reason to be megel? So he acknowledges, as you said, that's a shiloh, but being that it's a sveka d'oraisa, he's not willing to rely on that to get us out of the problem here. And he also has an extensive discussion, and this is one of the major issues that the poskim debate in this specific question, is how much of a percentage do you have to worry about? So he goes through the parameters of mi'ir hamatzui, when something is present to a significant degree. It's a whole machlokas what that means. Mishkanas Yaakov famously understood it to be 10%, others thought more. He goes through some discussion about that. So his assumption is that they are big enough for this to be a problem, and it is mi'ir hamatzui. So really, he assumes that one does need to have filtered water in order to address this problem. However, he says theoretically you could address it without a filter. If you're somewhere without it, you'd have to physically look at the water in a clear glass against a surface that allows you to see. He says if you have good eyesight and you're able to see things on a average level and you can look careful and you can see there isn't anything in them, so then that would be enough. But otherwise, he does assume that it needs to be filtered. There's also a discussion that comes up in the context of all the buggy issues, that what if it's cooked? So if it's cooked, can we assume that that dismembers the bugs, that that destroys them and makes them lose their status as such items? So here he writes that there was tests done on this. He said a short period of time does not have that effect, 10 minutes or so, but if it's cooked for a longer period of time, then it seems like it does take them apart. So he says if the issue is it was water that happened to have been cooked or water that was used in cooking, so then that's a basis to be made a lawsuit. But theoretically speaking, practically speaking, he thinks there is a significant issue here. The pasuk also, that this pasuk Mem Gimel that we read already, aye?
Does that mean that if you hold like that, if somebody else uses non-filtered water, then all their kelim are treated?
No, so we said in terms of kelim, so Tom is not also for the bug. So, right, so that's an important, very important factor that helps. So here, but this pasuk that we mentioned here, after Shaktsuos Nafsho Seichem, so just first that part of it, so that's the prohibition about tishaktsu. So it sounds like it means you should not do disgusting things by eating these bugs. But we know that Shas in a few places, the Rambam in a few places, invokes this concept just in terms of general disgusting things, other disgusting things such as eating a living grasshopper, the Gemara has, or the Gemara has in Avodah Zarah, that if one, the Gemara has in Makkos rather, if one delays going to the bathroom, so that creates a disgusting situation. So, according to many, that's Anissa Daraisa of Bal Tishaktu, which then means the Pasuk is suggesting a different category, that we're talking about Machalas Asuris in general over here, but this would be an independent issur, that to do something which is disgusting would be prohibited by itself, even separate from any Machalas Asuris considerations. The Ritva in Makos takes this position also. He also, though, quotes the Yesh Omrim that it's an Asmachta, that it's not the Din Daraisa. But of course, as we've discussed a few times this year, that when the Ritva says something's an Asmachta, that might mean more than when others say something is an Asmachta, but that's a different discussion. But what about the end of the Pasuk? So, Lo Sitamu Bohem, Bohem, V'nitmesem Bam, and you would become defiled by them. So the Nitmesim here, you're missing an Aleph. And there is this discussion about Macholos Asuris or Metamte Misalev. They do something to mess up your heart. They do something to have a negative effect on you. And that's a tradition that we have, that by all the Surim and the Torah, there is a specific aversion to non-kosher food. Because of this idea, even though, strictly speaking, in terms of onshin, it's not as bad as other things. It's not as bad as Chol Shabbos or other types of averos. But as far as the effect that it has, this idea of Timtum Halev is one that traditionally has often been invoked as a additional zahirus against non-kosher food. So as far as Shas is concerned, the Gemara Maseches Yuma on Daf Lamed Tes Amud Aleph does make this point about Metamte Mesalev. The problem is that Gemara says that it's Avera Metamte Mesalev, that any Avera has a effect like this. It's not clear that it's talking specifically about Macholos Asuris in that Gemara. But the Mesil Susharim and others say that, yes, it's an idea by Averas in general, and Macholos Asuris are worse because you actually bring it into your body, so therefore the effect is going to be greater and more focused. So, yes, we specifically have this idea about Macholos Asuris. And this affects a number of issues of Psak. The Chassam Sofer talks about it in a tshuva, about if somebody is mentally incapacitated and therefore is Patam and HaMitzvos, he has the Halacha V'Shota, the question about whether such a person could be in an institution that serves non-kosher food. So he goes through the factors there, and one of the elements to consider is that, is there a Timtum Halev that is there independent of this individual's pter from mitzvos. This also comes up in the question of nursing. So let's say for a child, for a baby to nurse from a non-Jewish nurse, would that be a problem because of the influence of or nourishment from non-kosher foods? Shulchan Aruch recommends that if that's the arrangement, so that this woman who's nursing should be told not to eat non-kosher foods because of that concern. So there is such a notion. And it may also be specifically addressed to kashrus because of the idea that some of the Rishonim have, that the aversion that we have to certain foods has to do with an aversion to certain traits. So, for example, the Ramban understands by his commentary here in the Parsha, where he talks about prohibited birds, so therefore he writes that they are prohibited because they are predatory. And I'll take this occasion just to reiterate a vort we mentioned last year when we were talking about the birds. So in many schools, they teach the kids Dvar Torah, which sounds very nice, but I want to adapt it a little bit, because the Torah also prohibits a chasida. Some discussion what exactly a chasida is, but it's a nice name, chasida. In fact, there are fine Jewish women who have this name. It seems to be related to chesed. And Rashi there has this idea that she's called a chasida because osa chesed im chavrusa. She does chesed with her friends. So everyone asks, well then, why is she a treif bird? So that's the opposite of what's normally associated with a non-kosher bird. So the Dvar Torah, they usually say that the kids learn in school, is that the point is, im chavrusa, that she does chesed only with her friends and not with others. So I find that interpretation a little difficult. And I actually noticed in my grandfather's commentary to the Torah Tumim, I think he says the same point as Zertzai last week, so I'll just mention that. That, I didn't say it this way exactly, but I think he's getting at the same idea. It's hard to say that doing chesed with your friends is a reason that it should be a treif bird, because we're all limited in how we do chesed. We can't do chesed to everyone, and we do prioritize those who are closest to us. So to say that it's a midah that should constitute treifus, should constitute, well, treifus is not a technically correct term, should constitute a non-kosher type of animal because the chesed is limited, it's a little difficult to say with how we relate to the chiyuvim of chesed in general. So I think what the real intention there is that yes, these animals are predators, and even if they do chesed to those nearest to them, that doesn't change the fact that they are predators to other animals. So one shouldn't think that if somebody's vicious but he's nice to his mother, so then it doesn't matter that he's vicious, or somebody is cruel but is nice to his friends. You know, like they say, it's true about the Nazis and other great villains in history. It's not going to save you. So I think the emphasis here is not so much that the limited chesed is a problem, but it's the viciousness that's a problem, and chesed towards others does not purify the problem of it being dangerous to others. So in any event, the Ramban emphasizes this idea in general of these animals having something that's bad for us in a spiritual sense. Other Rishonim have this idea as well, and some have it from the opposite direction, because it sounds like what these Rishonim are saying, if you connect this to the idea of Timtum HaLev, there's some room to maybe see it differently. But if you assume that the idea that non-kosher food is Mentamtem HaLev is because of what's in them, or should you say the opposite, like the Maral says, it's a little bit synergistic because it's a little bit similar to things we were talking about this week. Should we say that it's not that it's bad, it's prohibited because Metamta Misalev. It's Metamta Misalev because it's prohibited, because it's usur, so that's where the negative spiritual effect is there. So it could have nafkaminas, this is something that the Rosh Weiss discusses as well, if you have the non-kosher food without the usur, like we've been discussing this week, let's say it was done b'shogeg or in other circumstances. So is there Timtum HaLev as well? So the Ramban comments about the whole need for a kapara b'shogeg because he understands that there is this negative effect. So it seems that this is a little shitaso, that if he understands the problem is with the food, not with the avera, so then even if the avera is b'shogeg, so then maybe the negative impact is there as well, just to add a point for the sake of synergy, and Chazar as well. So earlier in the year, when we talked about whether Yisurim Darabanan are inherent problems or not, so one of the rayas that maybe there is something inherently bad against the Nesivos, that there is something inherently bad by Yisurim Darabanan, is from the Shach. The Shach says that Timtum Halev is applicable even to Macholos Asuros Darabanan. So even if it's only rabbinically prohibited, it still has this negative essence to it, apparently, and that was brought up as a question against the position of the Nesivos. Okay, we're going to run out of time, so just to say a few other quick points. So first of all, the next Pasuk Mem Dalid, so it tells us, Ki ani Hashem Elokeichem, v'hiskadishtem, v'yisem kedoshim, ki kadosh ani, v'lo sitamu es nafshoseichem, v'chol asher tzarom esol haaretz. So what does it mean, v'hiskadishtem, v'yisem kedoshim? So here there's a whole discussion, the Gemara in Brachos and Daftan Gimel has the din of Mayim Rishonim and Mayim Achronim, that v'hiskadishtem is Mayim Rishonim, so the Rishonim have a discussion because the Gemara in Chulin sounds like the issue with Mayim Achronim is that it is Mishum Sakana, that we're worried that there is a Melech Sedoma, a certain kind of salt that's still on our hands and it can cause blindness, so we have to wash off our hands for that purpose. So the question comes up, okay, so maybe nowadays if we don't think we have that salt anymore, so Tosfos writes over there that we shouldn't have to do Mayim Achronim, and many rely on this, many assume that that's indeed the case, even though the Mishnah Berurah, the Aruch HaShulchan, were both very machmer about this. And the Tzad machmer could be to assume that, like some of the Rishonim explained, there's two dinim, there's one din Mishum Sakana, but also this Drasha seems to suggest it's for Kedusha purposes also, it's the purposes of benching, and the purpose of parallels, and Tilos Yadayim at the beginning, and that's one of the reasons some are more machmer about this. But Rashi has the idea, Kodshu as Atzmachem Lamata, and Visim Kedoshim, that Kodesh Baruch Hu, Aniya Kadesh Eschem Lamala. So you purify yourselves down here, and I'm going to do so, Kodesh Baruch Hu says, I'm going to do so above. So just to finish this point, so the we're actually going to run out of time in a second, but the Eish Tamid says, the Sefer by Druk, that the idea here is that the Kodesh Baruch Hu is saying that even if you find it hard to be Kodesh, so in essence, if you give the comparison, fake it till you make it. Basically, start acting like you are, and then Kodesh Baruch Hu will help you get there fully. So that's the idea. You sanctify yourself down here, and God will sanctify above. He will help make it true. It sounds like also Taurus Kohanim has the idea that Kodesh Baruch Hu is saying, just like I am Parish, just like I am separate, so too you should be separate as well, which sounds like it's a notion of halachta bedracha. This is one of the ideas that we have of imitating a Kodesh Baruch Hu. In terms of the notion of Kedusha, so this is really, this idea of Ki Kadosh Ani appears in the next pasuk. So that's where the Taurus Kohanim is commenting. But this idea also of Kedusha, just to talk about it quickly, so we know that the Rambam, particularly, and other Rishonim as well, make the association between Macholos Asuras and Kedusha. And Sefer Kedusha in the Mishnah Torah is about Macholos Asuras and Yisurei Bia. The assumption that there's a connection between the two, that prohibited physical relationships and prohibited food are all part of sanctity. Rabbeinu Bachya writes that sanctity is attained by imposing the seichel on the yetzer, and a person who's able to overcome his instincts and his taivus, that's a part of what Kedusha means, and that seems to be the message the Rambam is conveying by putting those two together under that title. Rav Asher Weiss, again, we'll give him basically the last word, that Rav Asher Weiss has a, almost the last word, that he has an essay about this, so again, in there in the Parsha, where he talks about how there really is this link in terms of the Yisur of Macholos Asuras and Yisurei Bia, that they're both about Hana, and the Hana that we're supposed to overcome, or at least direct in a permissible direction. And he notes that despite that connection, so there's still a difference that Macholos Asuras is treated as an Isser Chefza, that's how the Torah essentially formulates it, even though that's the theme, while Yisurei Bia, you don't have an Isser Chefza in that sense. So here's synergy, I just can't resist. So he notes that that's also relevant, just to put a bow on the sugya we've been learning this week. So the question which we discussed a little bit or was raised, so why is it, for example, that the Rosh Hashanah discusses, why is it that matzah shel tevel should be usur? Why is it mitzvah babi aveira, or whatever the reason is, that you can't eat matzah made of a tevel? Why don't we say that asay dochalos asay? That's a question we discussed at the beginning of that sugya, but sometimes we do find that you override an isur to fulfill a mitzvah. So the Rosh Hashanah discusses this and suggests that you never have a mitzvah that is an aveira at the same time. That's what we've been talking about, an aveira mitzvah and mitzvah aveira. When you say esei dochalosa, say, it's when there are two different things that happen to clash and they happen to take place at the same time, so then the mitzvah can take priority over the aveira. But when the same action and the same chefza is both a chefza shal mitzvah and a chefza shal aveira, that's what you can't have, and that's what this we see here reflecting this fact that Machalos HaSuris is formulated as an Isser. Should just close with a note also that this idea, there's a mitzvah of Havdalah that the Torah closes this parsha with, Lahavdil ben Hatame ben Hatara ben Achaya Nechels ben Achaya Shalose Achel. So sometimes you see the concept is discussion as far as sometimes mitzvahs Havdalah, and you think that's about what we say in Motzi Shabbos, but they point out that no, it's about finishing in 10 seconds. The mitzvah Havdalah is also to distinguish between what's kosher and what's not. So I say not to be confused with our Motzi Shabbos ritual, but the Gemara says that there is a link that somebody who's Mavdil Aliyah and Motzi Shabbos is Zochet to have children who are able to make distinctions. And it's crucial to understand that this ability to distinguish between good and bad, that's really the secret of life. And that's where the Gemara says that we, when we say Havdalah in benching, and Havdalah in tefillah, so we say it in Atachon and Tanu, we put it, how do you say Atachon and Tanu in Atachonein, because when we talk about Atachon al-Adam Das, so Das is contingent on being able to distinguish. And main Havdalah in Das, we have to be able to tell the difference between things, bad comparisons, and faulty Dimyonos is really the key to falling apart, is the key to making big mistakes, and the key to chachma is knowing what the difference between one thing is and another. That is the whole sod as to how to really reach wisdom, and therefore also some ask the question that why do we end this parsha on the words achay ein and achelus? It seems like a negative note, but the ikar of the pasuk is to be able to distinguish between one and the other, and that's a very positive note. That's the secret to all chachma. So before Abdullah, wish you a good Shabbos, and should be only good things.
You said the
iron thing?
Sorry?
You said the iron?
I love you, Jed. Can I un-